Okay, so first of all, thank you for hosting.
My pleasure.
Okay, so we're going to go through, these are like common questions that come up. This is not, in previous chaburas, we basically took one topic and sort of saw it through the prism of three different weeks. We sort of took a different topic each week, common issues in the workplace. So we're going to talk about first issue is common yichud type issues in the workplace. Then we talk about some kashrus issues, and then the second topic will be Shabbos issues, and then kashrus issues. Okay, so the first was about was in terms of yichud issues. Okay, so the general rule, there are certain Chazal made, our sages made certain rules like, 2,000 years ago. And some of them perhaps, some of them may seem less relevant nowadays and some seem more relevant. I think the yichud issue is maybe some of the technicalities we can debate, but in terms of the concept, I think is obviously, today's day and age is very relevant. So what's the difference? So what is permitted in terms of yichud from the sources that you saw in the Gemara? What is permitted in terms of how many men and how many women? Is this permitted then with all of you?
A man and two women.
It is. My wife's in town. We're actually not discussing that. If your wife's in town, so then it's permitted.
A woman with two men.
Right. So one woman with two men is permitted, and for a man he needs to be with three women. Okay, and that's. Now, the one clarification regarding the two men with one woman, and by the way, we're talking about here, we're this really got into one of the sources that we saw in the fourth source about the Gemara in Kiddushin Daf Pei Amud Beis, where it says Lo Shanu Ela Bikshirim. We're talking about people who want to follow halacha, and that things happen and you want to try to stay away from potential problems. But we're talking about what's called ksherim. So all these rules in general, by the way, all these rules of yichud, where we say that two men can be with one woman secluded, and one man can possibly be with three women. We're talking about the case of the two men and one woman, we're talking about ksherim. We're talking about people. How do you define ksherim? And so you saw that, remember that fourth source, right? It says Amar. If you saw that, the Gemara in Kiddushin says that a man cannot seclude himself with two women, right? So that's how we translate upset. Okay, now that gives a lot of guidance, right? So what is upset? So it's fascinating. So it depends what culture you belong to in terms of what the definition of ksherim is. So I'll give you one definition, which you might find shocking, but depends who the audience is. The Shevet Halevi of Vosner says that the definition of ksherim is that they don't have a TV. Now, again, he's speaking to a certain clientele. Rav Sobolovsky from YU, that's his clientele, it's a different clientele. Rav Sobolovsky, he said he doesn't think that, he thinks it's hard to define, but let's say people who don't watch inappropriate movies. Now, what to define inappropriate movies, but we have a better getter. So he wouldn't say that someone who has a TV, he wouldn't say that someone who has a TV necessarily is someone who's not kosher, but that's how he would, it's not necessarily someone who's Shomer Shabbos, because we're talking about someone who potentially might slip up. So we're talking about, that's what defined in terms of that. And obviously, if you have two ksherim, two upstanding individual, two men with one woman, so then that's not a problem of yichud. Sometimes, and then there is a debate between Rashi and the Rambam. I've just brought you Rashi's position in source 3, where Rashi says that, like I mentioned, that where the Gemara says, the Mishnah says that one man with two women is not a problem of yichud, but one man with three women, right, is fine. Okay? So that's what you want to try. That's during the daytime. You know, if you're ever stuck at the office at night, we're much more concerned. But sometimes you have these situations at work where you have a meeting with the boss or a meeting with the client and someone from the opposite, gender, and you want to open the door, you have to open the door. You don't have to open, that gets a little uncomfortable at times. When Rochi Fryer was here, she was totally comfortable doing all this stuff. So she used to be an inspiration to all of us. But sometimes it's a little bit uncomfortable. Sometimes when you have a business meeting, and it's many of us perhaps work in all, maybe in a Jewish or from environment, so it's easier to do that. But sometimes people don't work in a from environment, so it's harder. So how can we? So what are some leniencies that we could apply here? In other words, let's assume that not during the night, during the nighttime we're even more concerned, but let's say it's during the daytime. If you have two men and one woman in a room, the two men are kshirim, they're upstanding, then we don't have a problem. If it's one man and three women, then according to many Rishonim, it is a debate. The Shulchan Aruch says that, in a pinch, you can be mekel, you could be lenient. But let's say you're not in that situation. You have to meet a client, you have to meet your boss or someone else, and you're stuck in the office with them. What potential leniencies do we learn?
There's no one else around.
Well, let's say in your office.
In your office, and someone may walk in and.
Right. So what's that concept in Hebrew, or what is that called? Right. So that's the leniency that we learned. There are a number of leniencies. I sort of tailor made the yichud shir for a business context. There is another type of leniency if your spouse is in town. It's not so relevant in most business contexts. Obviously, I know Eva, you were there. That's an unusual situation, but they work together. But I'm saying the most common application of a leniency when it comes to yichud in the business context is how to apply the leniency of Pesach Pasuach. Right, the Gemara that was in source 6 of the first source sheet, the Gemara in Kedushin Pei Aleph Amud Aleph says, Amar Rabbi Yosef, Pesach Pasuach Lirshus Arabim, Ein Choshishim Mishum Yichud. Right, if you have the door open to the public domain, we're not concerned about yichud. So why are you not concerned about yichud? Okay, so you're too scared to do anything. Again, we're talking about people who are generally God-fearing. The laws of Yichud are not made for people who are prone to sin, who don't care. I just want to make you understand. People, we're all human, we make mistakes, but the laws of Yichud are designed to help prevent situations of people forgetting and slipping up. So if there's some kind of fear, the question is how much fear? So if the door is open, so anyone can walk in. So one of the questions that the Rishonim, that the commentators on the Gemara have to explain is how do we understand this? Do we take this literally? It has to be open
or unlocked
or another. It's how do we define this term of Pesach Pasuach? So that's why I brought you the Tshuva of the Rashba in Source 7, where they said that no. He says it doesn't have to be open. It could be closed as long as it's what?
As long as it's unlocked, right?
As long as it's unlocked. Why? Because in the context where you're concerned, if you're concerned that someone may walk in, it may not apply to a house. If the house door is just closed and there's no expectation someone's going to come in, it's not our topic now. But certainly in the business context, if you have an office door that's closed, right, and anyone could walk in, so that would seem to be a nice leniency, a way to get out of and people can walk in and out. So that could be a leniency when it comes to the problem of Yichud. Or Moshe Feinstein has an even greater leniency. It's the same principle, but what was his leniency in Source 8?
could be locked if you're in a situation where as soon as someone would knock on the door, you'd be prone to answer it.
Right, right. So that's Rav Moshe Feinstein Sarsay, this is from the Eben Ezer, Chelak Dal Simon Samachay, where he says Kevan Shederach Kulei Alma, since it's the way of that everyone Kishishon Misha Noki Faladelet, as soon as someone knocks on the door, rings the bell, then you're going to, you know, you hear, you're going to, come, you're going to come right away and answer the door. So then that's enough of a fear. Again, it has to be a situation.
Job loss, and, you know, even if the door is locked, let's say, you know, fear of job loss of anyone acting on.
Right.
You know,
so.
The workplace.
Yeah, so it's a good question.
Human, you know,
I understand.
I had a training today, actually. This is very appropriate.
Right. You know, so they talk about, so there's a discussion, what if you put cameras in the room, right? So that's like a discussion. What if they put cameras in the room, actually?
Right,
right?
But even
not.
I imagine in the actual workplace.
Right.
People would be too fearful of.
No, but by the way, the Me Too movement is someone taking advantage of someone else. We're talking about something that's even consensual, which is.
Oh, okay.
So I say I don't know. I mean,
right.
You're right. There are.
I would want to quit if someone made me be in a locked room with them. For fear of job loss,
okay.
Like that would be enough of like right. Harassment situation.
Well, I know
to be like,
yeah. Brad, when he has, because he has students that come in there like 16, 17,
right.
He keeps the door open.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's also for,
right.
You know, the balance, for his protection, because
right.
They could say that he
doesn't say the same thing.
Right.
So you leave the door open.
Right.
The same thing.
Right. So right. I mean, there are, it's not in this context, the Chava, but like in the question of like, let's say you have an adopted child, so is there a heter of yichud for an adopted child? Okay, so we looked at that, right.
Yeah.
So remember, so we talked about how Rav Moshe Feinstein's opinion was. So if he says if you're married, Rav Moshe Feinstein said if you're married, then there's a heter yichud. Why? Because your wife will kill you. If she finds out. No, I'm just saying. Whereas other Tzitzaliyot has a different way of looking at it. So there are some formulations based on that. I don't know this specifically. And Rav Moshe, by the way, would be strict if the person wasn't, in other words, if his wife died already. Whatever, we discussed it, I think. But I think that's what leniency. And then you have this other tshuva by Rav Moshe, who's even, I mean, the job loss is really the next source with Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, where Rav Moshe Feinstein in Eben Ezer Chelak Dal Siman Samech Hey, where it seems that if someone is in the room, then that's a principle. I mean, it's what you're saying, the Chumash, is lo mare umnase, that there would be professional repercussions if you would act inappropriately. If you notice in that tshuva, Rav Moshe Feinstein only said that if there was someone else in the office. In other words, would he say that if there was no one else in the office? I'm not sure. I don't think he would necessarily say that. If there was no one else, in the office. So he does it, that principle is applied. But to make it a little more lenient, but I'm not sure if that would win out on its own. It could be that in the future maybe something, you know, could be, but each case is different. In any case, there are procedures, in dealing with doctors and nurses frequently come in and out, so it's probably generally not an issue.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah,
the
sure.
Door is locked.
Right.
I work in this high school.
Right.
But like each door has a glass.
Right, so they can see, yeah. So yes, so they can, if they can see this, so that should be.
That's okay.
Yeah, that should be okay because they can see there. That's just like Pesach Pasuah, where the kids can see. Should vote on that? Should put it. Well, I don't meet so much in my shul office, but I actually suggested that at some point. I mean, I don't generally meet people. It's not, whatever. I meet people, you know, at home in someone's home, but they should probably do that in the show office also, by the way. Next time you discuss this, put a glass door.
Put it on the agenda.
But in any case, so that's generally. Then you had the last piece was this, you know, the elevator question. Right?
Not enough time.
Not enough time, right. So that it needs to be enough time to actually be physically intimate, not just hugging and kissing. So for the most part, you know, an elevator is not an issue. I didn't bring you sources. I forgot to bring you sources about the handshaking question. So in terms of the handshaking question, so it's interesting. Rav Moshe Feinstein in print has said it's forbidden to shake hands with the opposite gender, but he told people in person that there are times one could be lenient. Someone told me, I didn't ask Sandra Gottesman this directly, but I was paying a shiva call to someone, and you know, Sandra Gottesman was she was secretary to Moshe Feinstein. She was a secretary. She was a secretary. So a long time ago, right. So I think she may have seen. I want to double check this. Someone reliable said that she'd seen their emotion at time. There was a time once when. So even non-affectionate touching is forbidden. Okay, when you're dealing with everyone else, only negia derech chiba is forbidden. Only affectionate touching is forbidden. So it's hard to argue, you know, if someone puts out their hand and you accept it, that that's their chiba. See, if you do get, you know, if there is some feeling of affection, then it's a very serious sin. So that's why some people like to try to keep place a fence and not shake hands. Maybe people aren't used, whatever the case is. I'm saying that there are, there are some Rishonim who say that if you derive benefit or you feel whatever, it's very, you do it in an affectionate way, and you embrace someone or shake someone's hand in an affectionate kind of way, then that could be like, whatever, it could be a hard vayav or some say. Like, because it's like a secondary thing. It's like close to being physically intimate. So there are some Rishonim who talk about it very serious if you do have improper intent. And it could be that people who generally abstain from any kind of contact with the opposite gender, so any little touch, and they may get, maybe something more exciting than someone perhaps who generally interacts with some of the people of the opposite gender. So the point is, on a strict level, if it's not derech chiba, it probably is, acceptable. But we should understand why people don't do it, and sometimes people get offended. I think if people do it, it's hard. I mean, sometimes I've been successful in avoiding, sometimes I haven't been successful. I remember when I was the rabbi in my only other show, I've been a rabbi. So the other clergy people, the chaz, whatever. So the women all embraced everyone. So I remember when I was I walked around. They took the same tour around the women's section of that show, and so I walked around, and then all of a sudden all these women were shaking my hand. You know, the first Shabbos there, so it was a little of a culture shock for me. I kept my cool. The next week I made sure to hold a sitter with both heads. You try to avoid it. But I'm saying there are heterim, but it's good to try to avoid these things. You know,
is there a difference between accepting a hand and putting out your hand? If you're going on an interview, you have to be proactive.
You have to, yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. I mean, it looks bad if you're not putting your hand out right now.
Okay. I mean, if that's the, you're saying an interview, you always have to be the first one to do it?
You just want to look like proactive and interested in business. Okay. So.
Yeah, the question where you draw the line, like also for a client, you also want to be like, I don't know. I mean, again, if it's not their chibat, I never had to solicit, you know, business like that. My limited time in the workplace, I think I was generally able only to, you know, receive as opposed to, but it's probably not technically, if it's not their chiba, it's probably technically okay. You know, it's good sometimes to create fences because you never know where you draw the line. I think it's acceptable. I can't say it's usher like that. I think it's acceptable not to to explain, to not hug someone. I've been in those situations. But I think as an author, what I'm saying is I don't think that's. And again, I'm not saying. I think that's something that people can. First of all, especially in today's environment. Yeah. I think, especially in today's environment, I think you could. I mean, I was gonna say the only time that I ever put my hand out to a woman that I remember is when after we did like a business deal and everyone was hugging each other, so someone came to embrace, so I put on my hand.
That
was my defense. So I think in today's day and age, I think we can get around because where you draw the line with that, and I think we can. You know, avoid that. That's my opinion.
I hate hugging in the workplace. Yeah. I hate it. It would have to be somebody that I've known for like a million years.
Right. But by the way, that might be more problematic. By the way, what I'm saying is there's something about like if libo gospel, if you know the person and so then if they're hugging you, it could be. In other words, if you're hugging a stranger, that's just the etiquette. There's less of a concern that it means something as opposed to if you know the person very well. I'm just saying, halakhically, it's more, you know, it's more potentially problematic. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, I understand what you're saying. But I think it's harder to just not accept the handshake at all. And I think it's
easier.
Awkward.
It is. Yeah.
No, I understand.
Actually, could you please not touch me?
No, no, I understand. I understand. But first of all, we shouldn't. It's important not to look down at people who are able to do that. I'm not saying that. There are people who like that's their mindset and they're able to stand with it. They're able to do it. So just that maybe we've just accepted it. I mean, I'm saying like I have. I think it's easier not to. Except you're not. I'm saying that might also not be their chiba to accept
it. When you work with people who are dying all day long. And people are constantly crying over their loved ones day long. And you know what? I have had instances where I either had to put my hand like this or whatever. But I have had times where I just felt like let me just sit here and just be here, you know. Right. And that was fine too. But I wouldn't be opposed to like.
If the family is someone that and they I would know if someone's like so emotional what I'm saying is listen as a rabbi also I've had to sit with people who are suffering or whatever it is maybe because I'm a rabbi but I've dealt with non-religious people. You know, also in terms of sitting with them, when I've been to the hospital and sitting with people, you know, obviously they expect something different from rabbis. So it's true. I can pull the rabbi card.
Totally.
No, I understand that. It's easier, but sometimes just sitting with them and being with them and speaking to them and kindly, you can get a lot. I know there's certain things that are expected, but you could also get a lot done.
Totally.
You know, I just think it's a sensitivity issue. And it's
I mean, they also look at me and they're like, oh, you're Jewish?
Right.
You know, so like they also know a lot of
them. I'm saying, I think these things, I think a lot of these things may not be, I can't tell someone that's definitely usher, because these things are probably not their chiba. It's sort of like what I tell, you know, I always tell my girls, you know, growing up, I always tell them, you know, if you high five a boy, I know what high fives nowadays mean. If you tap someone on the shoulder, Like, is that their chiba? May not be, but I said, it's not a problem. That's different. There's no reason to do that necessarily. I mean, there might be a reason, but I'm saying, like, you try to create fences for yourself so you don't.
I just think it's also, again, in the training we had today, because nowadays everyone has to go through this harassment training. But I just think it's just very important as like a natural rule. Like I don't touch you.
Right.
I don't tap you.
Right.
I don't do massages in the workplace. Don't touch me. I don't touch you.
I think it really depends on the workplace. Because I've had people when I've been working in my job for 15 years and they found out I was expecting or something and they want to give you a hug.
Right.
Such great news.
I understand. Okay.
But yes, totally.
Okay. So that's the first piece. So let's talk a little bit about Shabbos. So the Shabbos is a little complicated, right? Yeah.
Yes.
The definition is Beinah Shabbos. I tried to be clear, but maybe I wasn't so clear. Okay. So let's try to go through this.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'll do the best I. I'll do the best I can. Okay. So there's a debate in the Gemara. There are two Gemaras. One Gemara says that Bein HaShmashos, between the sunset, or between the end of the day and the beginning of the next day. See, Judaism is very complicated. We don't just move from one day to the next. There's always this in-between period, right? Everything in Judaism is complicated, right? You know, there's no like dropping the ball, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, New Year. You know, it's not like that. No, fine, now it's Bein HaShmashos and this, that. You know, we're a very complicated group. So the question is, how long is this time period? How long is this time period of Suffolk Yom, Suffolk Lila? Is it doubt whether it's a day or the night? Is it what's called 4 meal, or is it 3/4 of a meal? Mem Yud Lamed. In Hebrew, a meal is the time it takes to walk 18 minutes. Okay? Okay? So is it 72? So is the time between the end of the day and beginning of the next day, is it 72 minutes? Or is it 3/4 of a meal, which is 13.5 minutes? Okay?
You're a speed walker.
It's a meal, everyone agrees, a meal is 18 minutes. Question is, from however you define the end of the day and the beginning of the next day, we're not going to discuss that, like the different calculations, but is it 72 minutes or is it, you know, 13.5 minutes. When you hear about people keep the Zman of Rabbeinu Tam, you hear that? Like the Rabbeinu Tam Zman? So when they say, like, they accept Shabbos until you know, Rabbeinu Tam. So what that means is that they keep Shabbos until 72 minutes following sunset. Like, say, like at Yom Devotion side, we generally, we keep Shabbos, we end Shabbos about 42 minutes after sunset, about an hour after candle lighting. So we do like 42 minutes, like between candle lighting and sunset's 18 minutes, and we do another 42 minutes. Usually Shabbos ends, you know, you ask your average young Israel, Shabbos ends about an hour after it starts, right? After candle lighting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have like an hour. What?
25
hours. Right. So behold Zman Rabbeinu Tam, so what you're really saying is it's after... No, it's more than that. It's 25 and a half hours because it's 72 minutes after sunset.
Plus
right. In other words, it's the 18. It's after the 18. What? No. So what I'm saying is, if you hold like Rabbeinu Tam, if you hold like Shita's opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, that's the strict. It's not the strict. There are strict views, but for purpose of that, we're going to say there's potentially. You could adjust it depending on the brisk, whatever. There are potentially longer. No. So I'm saying there's a dispute in the Gemara as to whether this time period is it 4 meal, which is 72 minutes, or is it 3/4 of it, which is like 13.5 minutes.
What's the significance of a meal?
The meal is just how long it takes you to walk, a certain distance, 18 minutes. That's a measurement of time. It's a measurement of time. There's nothing more than that. I'm sorry. it's a measurement of time. Mem Yud Lamed.
Like an arbitrary measurement of time.
It's a certain measurement of time. There's no halakhic significance of it. Mm-hmm. It's just saying your average person it takes to walk. Your average, you know, they could have said right. They could have measured, you know, in units of time, but they measured it in units of distance. In other words, they're saying that the time between. You know, when the one day ends and the next day begins, is the time it takes someone to walk 4 mil. or the time it takes.
Why is that a better way to
measure than time itself?
Time.
Because
they didn't have clocks back then.
They didn't have clocks. Yeah, there's no, like, how would you measure time in days of the Gemara?
With a sundial?
Okay, but that's complicated, no?
Candles?
No, but I'm saying, like, think about it. They didn't have, I mean, you're saying, how do you measure 18 minutes?
Well, what's the significance of 18 minutes?
No. They believe. Let's say they believe that it's like. Let's say we believe it's 72 minutes between the end of one day and beginning of the next day, right? We believe it's 72 minutes. So the question is, how are you going to write that in? How are you going to tell people that it's time it takes for you to walk 72 minutes? How are you going to tell people who don't have a clock, who don't when the sun is like this much? Like how do you start? We're talking about nighttime anyway. So the best measurement in those days without a watch is actually the time it takes your average person to walk this distance.
But is meal like mile?
What is it?
It's
like,
not.
Like,
a,
how did they come up with meal?
Is it a mile? It's close to it. I forget exactly. It's close to a mile.
Sounds like around.
Yeah, it's around the mile.
Yeah.
It's around the mile. Yeah, but it's around the mile. So you have this debate. Is it? No, but I'm saying. I mean, think about that. That's what they're dealing with in those days. Like that's why, you know, when they have these measurements, you know, it has to be the size of a kazayas or a kibbutzah. How big is that? Because they didn't have pounds or rulers. So they use foods. I mean, that's what they use in order to guide people, like your average, ordinary stuff that people had. And that's what they did. So this is, they measured time by walking. And they measured, you know, what's the earliest time to recite Kriyat Shema?
Measure the time by walking.
No, your average, they knew, they said the time between the end of the day and the beginning of the night, what we call the night, is this time. That's what we think the time is. So you know if you're wherever you are, and you and that time that it takes. So you know it takes on average 72 minutes, whatever it is. They don't. No one says 72 minutes. They don't have a clock.
Right. I know. I mean, that's how I'm wondering how they figured this out to begin with.
No. So they
like
they experimented.
Walk a mile and look at their watch. And
They look at their watch. They probably experimented for how long. How were they calculated when the stars come out? How many stars? Whatever the case. How were they calculated? They experimented.
So then how did we end up
with this debate?
Okay, wait. So what I'm saying is that, so there are different debates of what's considered night. There's different debates
as
to what's considered.
Okay, so the debate is not about this.
Right. The debate is like, is night like an earlier part of the darkness or is it a later part of the darkness? That's really the question, really. You know, when does the day end? You know, we think the day ends when the sun sets, but maybe Kotra Beit Tam, you know, that's why Hasidim, right? So they'll daven mincha, you know, after sunset, according to me, right? They'll daven mincha much later. For me, I can't daven mincha anymore. They're still davening because they say until 72 minutes after what I call sunset, it's not fully, you know, they're going to say that for the next 60 minutes or 60 plus minutes, you know, we think it's dark. It's still halachically day. I don't want to get into that. That's a complicated, debate. But I want to give you a little taste of what that is. So the debate is whether it's 72 minutes or 13 and a half minutes. So the reason why this is now, it makes it a little, so that's the first step. The next step is that Rav Moshe Feinstein says that really, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, I agree that Rabbeinu Tam is right. Okay, he says, I agree Rabbeinu Tam is right. And in Eretz Yisrael, it's 72 minutes. But in America, it's because we're different distance from the equator, it's only 50 minutes. You know, the 72 minutes in Israel between, you know, the beginning of the, between the end of one day and the beginning of the next day, and as adjusted to America, that's only 50 minutes. Okay? Now, you got that? You go from 72 minutes to 50. Now, If you hold like Rabbeinu Tam, okay, so if you say it's 72 minutes, right, you have one time period which is 72 minutes, you have one time period which is 13 and a half minutes, right, 4 meal and 3/4 meal, okay, so you have from that whole, so according to Rabbeinu Tam, until the last 3/4 meal, until the last 13 and a half minutes, right, so the first 60 minutes is day. The last 13 minutes, right, is Beit HaShmashos, and then you have the next day. That if you're a follower of Rabbeinu Tam, if you're a follower of Rabbeinu Tam, then you're going to say the first 58 and a half or 59 minutes after sunset is day, and the last 13 minutes is what we call Beit HaShmashos, and then it's night. Okay? Is that, mm-hmm. you with me? Mm-hmm. Rav Moshe Feinstein adjusts that. So he said in America, so if you do the math, you do like, therefore, but he said that's in Israel. So that's 72 minutes. So now you go to America, it's instead of 72 minutes, it's 50 minutes. Right? So of that 50 minutes, the last 9 minutes is Beit HaShmashos. So if you do the, whatever, 72 over... Was it?
Yeah, okay, right.
Right? In other words, if you have 59 minutes of day, right, after we call sunset, you have 59 minutes of day, the next 13 minutes is Beit HaShmashos, and then it's the next day. Right? So for Moshe, he's saying, let's do the equivalent. So you have, he's saying it's 50 minutes, right? And then the last 10 minutes or 9 minutes is Beit HaShmashos. Before that, according to Beit HaTam, is Vadai day, is definitely day. Why is that relevant? So this is what we're getting at, that if you're stuck at work, and you should be stuck at work, but if you're stuck at work, right, and you need to take a taxi home, you could rely on Amira Ladachri, you could rely on, right, the Shulchan Aruch says, I had you in source one, in Reish Samach Alf Sif Aleph, who says that you could tell a non-Jew, Bein HaShmashos, to do malacha for you. Mm-hmm. Bein HaShmashos to do malacha for you. So now, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, we have this debate between, let's say, Rabbeinu Tam, who I just described to you, and the Gaonim. The Gaonim, you know, hold that, no, the first 13 minutes, really it's nighttime after the first 13 minutes adjusted. You know, we also adust it.
Is this the time after the 18 minutes?
Yes, yes, yes. So the truth is, in Israel, if you know, in Yerushalayim, how long is it, Beit HaShmashos? Like 20 minutes? Right, it's about 20 minutes. Because they don't hold like Rabbeinu Tam. That minute of Yerushalayim, which is 20 minutes, it's really like the Gaonim, but it's adjusted. We let's say in our shul, that we hold 42 minutes, we hold like the Gaonim adjusted. We don't hold like Rav Moshe Feinstein. But we're using Rav Moshe Feinstein to be lenient. Rav Moshe Feinstein says like this. The first 40 minutes after sunset is certainly day, according to Rabbeinu Tam, and it's either Beit HaShmashos or nighttime, according to the other opinion. So since there's a debate whether it's day or night, you could be lenient for the first 40 minutes after sunset. So the point is, if you're stuck on the road, you could have a non-Jew do, like, drive you, right? You could have a non-Jew drive you for the first 40 minutes. Now, if you're with your kids, there could be pikuach nefesh issues, so there might be more reason to be leading even after the 40 minutes. But the point is that the first 40 minutes, if you're stuck, you could rely on a non-Jew, and you should try to, in those 40 minutes, you try to make sure you get to a place where you could stay for Shabbos. And obviously, there's more complicated. But that's in a pinch, the most lenient view to rely on a non-Jew.
And the 40 minutes start at
from
candle,
sunset. No, at sunset.
After
sunset.
After
the 18 minutes.
So 18 plus 40.
Right, right.
18 you can still.
It's 18 you can, right, right.
So you can still do yourself.
Yeah, right? Moshe fights, he has a tshuva about this, where people thought he was like Michal Shabbos, so he said he's going to stop working in the 18 minutes. Because he felt like, you know, you really, there's something called Tosefta Shabbos that you're supposed to add on to, you know, like you keep Shabbos and you're supposed to add on to Shabbos a few minutes. It's a question, how much? There's a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein where he says, people saw me being driven in a car during the 18 minutes. So I'm going to stop doing that, but there's really no problem with it. But we're talking about, you know, if you get it within the 18 minutes, you haven't been Michal Shabbos. We're talking after the 18 minutes to have a non-Jew drive you in a pinch. So that's you know, the most that you could be, you know, lenient with. You know, I also, there are those who disagree. I brought you Rav Zilberstein who disagrees. He holds like the Gaonim, but in a pinch, you probably could rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein. And, you know, what do you think about taking a bus or a, I didn't bring any sources, but what do you think about taking like a bus or, well, you can't get on, you have to pay money, so that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But can you stay on a train? right? There might be leniencies to also.
If you're on the train.
You might even, if someone pays for you, get in a pinch. You know,
you have to know that your train driver is not Jewish, or you can assume.
You could assume. You shouldn't ask. In general, by the way, don't ask. If you have a cab driver, you're in a pinch, and he's driving you. Don't start conversations. Oh, Sabbath. Oh, I know Sabbath. I light candles and I go to sit in. Don't start conversations. It's a bad thing. Don't start conversations. No, because you can rely. We can rely on Rove. We can rely on majority, let's say, you know, in America, that they're probably not Jewish. But just don't start the conversation. Because once you put yourself in that situation, then it's very uncomfortable.
Are there rabbinic sources that have different timings for other places on Earth? Meaning, you have an adjustment from Israel to America. What about other places?
I'm sure there are. Like I said, Yerushalayim is different. What I'm saying is Yerushalayim.
Talks about Europe.
Right. You said right.
I'm curious about the Europe thing actually, right. Because I wouldn't think that Europe and America are really.
Right. So the question is, what's the timing from when? I mean, it's a question from when sunset is to when three stars come out. And the truth is, it should be different. It's also, first of all, it's also different in America for the season. It's also a minute or two off depending on the season.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it should be in some places, the far north or south you go, it should be different based on that. You know, you have some place. Yeah, I mean,
but there's no like formula for figuring this out.
I'm sure there is a formula for figuring it out. I'm sure there's a formula.
Like we did a Shabbos in Scotland, and like Shabbos was forever.
Right.
Like it was. It went to like 11:30 at night. I mean,
that's because the day is longer.
But meaning everything there must have been different. Like I imagine.
So you plug it in. If you go to mizmanim.com, so they're going to tell you when this degrees are like when three small stars come out. So between when the sun sets and when three small stars come out.
It starts about the last right?
It depends on the day. It depends.
But
some places that are farther up north, the day is much.
In France also, Shabbos was like very, very late.
Also, Alaska that doesn't have
Australia, the season is
well. I said that's the season, but they're right. The place there's no day, right? We could talk about that. If there's no nighttime, so then that's a question. You have to pick time. But that's only certain period of time.
You make your own time.
I think that there. It's awkward though. Yeah,
we couldn't do it.
I'm not interested in anywhere cold.
And we were just looking outside, and it was like sunny out, and it was like
I don't know if I would have given up.
So maybe it wasn't.
I think the question is if it's just daylight the whole time, but if it gets dark, then I think
you'd have to.
Yeah, I'd like to know. I think if it gets dark, you wait till it gets dark.
I recall we were given. It was.
Oh yeah. Okay. I don't know.
Like 2005.
Okay.
So we were given a time.
Okay.
But a few, like many years ago, I was living on the west side and I was going to the Heights for Shabbos, and there was a jumper on the bridge or something. So like,
oh my God.
There was traffic, train, everything. And like, on the 18th minute, I got out of my cab in the middle of somewhere between the west side and the Heights and I just walked.
Right.
But like, are you saying in this case, and it turned out there were a whole bunch of us who did that, but are you saying in this case, like, I could have relied on that 40, like, paid him then, and then just said, take me.
Yeah, you would be allowed to rely on him to take you.
You told us once about danger also.
If there's a dangerous situation. But here's the thing. The thing with the danger thing is, what you really, what, see, this is what we don't want to do this. We want to get to the place we want to get to.
Yeah.
We don't want to. No. What I'm saying is, we don't want to pull over. The real thing to do is to pull over to find some place and have a miserable Shabbos in some like hotel or some motel. Like, we don't want to do that, so we pull the danger. No, I'm saying if there's real danger, then you can rely on it. But if you're seeing that you're stuck, you're really supposed to try to find like something where you could just pull over to the side and. It's not easy, I'm saying, but that's ideally you're supposed to do.
Well, let's call this Spanish Harlem.
No, I know, I understand. No, in your situation, I understand. It might be different.
Like,
and there's also a difference if you're going by yourself and going with the group,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
Saying, like, there's...
That's where you got out of Spanish Harlem.
What?
You got out there?
Yeah, it was wherever between the west side and the Heights, and I was in a cab, and there was too much traffic, and...
That's crazy.
Just walk the rest of the way. But that was...
I mean, it's for needs. So the question is, how difficult is it? And how to, the truth is, it might even be better to have them... Was there an Arab when you were going?
I mean, there was an Arab on the west side and an Arab on the Heights, but I have no idea what was...
Right, right. Because actually, the guard would probably drive you, then you probably could... Because here there's a problem about carrying stuff. So that's the one thing. If you're taking the train... And let's say you're continuing it, you know, you get off when it's Shabbos. So, question: what would you do with you'd want to, if you know you're missing for Shabbos? You want to find the conductor and tell them, you know, hold this, and hopefully they will hold it for you. And whatever, you pick it up after Shabbos. Like, that's a problem. What you can do with your wallet? That's
you
a problem.
Said, the source said something weird about like the 4 hours.
Oh, you can 4 hours. Right. So if you do that the whole time, so that and then you stop. Yeah, and then you But then you would probably, it's complicated also, because that's only in Rishus HaRabim, as opposed to going from one Rishus to the next Rishus. In other words, you probably could keep on doing that, which would be very weird, and then hopefully find someone. You'd probably have to get to right by the Eruv. You have to know where the Eruv is. You have to go right before the Eruv and have someone then, you know, maybe wait for, like, in other words, wait for someone. No, I'm saying is you probably want to do is you'd probably like go less than 4 hours and then have a goy that wait for a goy to maybe take it inside the area for you. But I'm saying the carry thing is complicated. Right. There are heterim if the money is in your. That's what's become Motzei Shabbos. But there are heterim if money is. If you have it with you. So there might be heterim to carry it indirectly. We have to come Saturday night. We'll talk about that. Okay. But the point is at the very least. So the point is at the very least a trade. There's a chew by the Chassam Sofer who says that taking a trade might be uvda dechol. But again, so those are the least. In a pinch, you have the possibility of what were you saying? In the pinch, you have the possibility of. You know, the non-Jew driving you up to 40 minutes, and if you're on the train, there's probably leniency at a pinch. The other issue at work is like telling someone to do work for you on Shabbos, right? So if you don't give the non-Jew a time frame to do the malacha, and he could do it, or she could do it not on Shabbos, and so that's not a problem. That's what's called a daite de nafshe. If you, like, you know, you give your car... You know, in the shop, in the mechanic, and you say you want it back Monday. You give it 2 minutes before Shabbos on Friday. You say, I want the car back on Monday. Mm-hmm. You know that the store is closed, the shop's closed on Sunday. It's irrelevant because he could still do the work on Sunday. If you say, I want it, if you say, I need the work Saturday night, like right away after Shabbos, that's a problem to tell a non-Jew to do that. The one leniency is... If you, like, you know, I remember I had this when I was working. You know, sometimes, like, you know, when you know, can you FedEx this overnight? So that's a problem. So you try to avoid it. If you can't avoid it, there is a potential leniency, because there's something called, I did have that source about Amira La Amira. I think it was in. I think I had that in source. I think 8 or 9, when the Shulchan Aruch Siman Shin Zayin Sifayin Mishnah Brura Sif Katan Chav Dalet, where he points out that there are some Achrodi who say that Amira La Amira might be okay with a non-Jew b'makom hefsed in times in a situation of major financial loss. So if like your boss tells you to do something, so obviously you try to avoid it. But if you might lose your job or something with like that, so then you have that in your back pocket, that if your job is to, let's say, give it over to FedEx a document. So you're telling one person to FedEx that she's gonna tell someone else. You call up, they are probably not gonna deliver themselves. So you have that in your back pocket. There's a mira b'makom hefsed gadol. So you have that potential leniency if need be. If you're telling a Jew to do malacha for you on Shabbos, I don't know. That's like a hard one.
Does this apply to Yom Tov also? Because then I could see being more of an issue. Like, yeah. If Yom Tov's on weekday.
Yeah, that's also an issue. So, but again, you have that. For Yom Tov. Yeah, but it's the same. Right. If you tell.
We're more strict on Shabbos anyway.
We are more strict. So you have shvus to shvus. It depends if it's an issue, but you're telling him to do a malacha doraisa. You know, you could be, you know, shvus to shvus of makom tzorech that's prohibited on Shabbos or on Yom Tov. So if you have something which is only a rabbinic prohibition on Yom Tov, and there's a need for it, like here, there's a need for this, so then you'd be allowed to tell a non-Jew directly to do it. My point to you is that it depends what the malacha is, really. But the point here is that it's a tough one if you have a Jew working for you who's not observant. That's a tough one. I'm not sure how to get around it. You know, it's a hard one for that situation. If it's a non-Jew, then he's going to don't ask. But sometimes you know the person, so yeah, I'll handle it for you. Try to make it, try as best as you can not to tell him directly. I mean,
that's the same thing with the time frame. You just don't give a time frame and...
Right, but sometimes there is a time frame. I'm just saying you're right.
Right.
But my point is, with a non-Jew, if there is a time frame, you have this leniency of amira la amira. With a Jew, it's a hard one. I have to think about it.
Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of my work.
Yeah.
Like, let's say I see more of a yontif issue.
Right.
Like, let's say something's due like Thursday morning,
right,
or Tuesday, Wednesday. Can you just say, I can assume they're coming in early Thursday morning to do it?
Yeah, if they have a possibility of doing it, if they have a possibility...
So you know they're
right,
not.
They're not. Yeah, that's fine. The key is if you leave like right before Yom Tov, and like there's no way they could do it, that gets a little bit harder. In other words, try to time it so that you give them enough time where they possibly, if they work like, say, over, you know, where they can work overnight or whatever, like... Try to create a situation where it's possible where they can do the work not at Yom Tov.
We actually do this all the time. I'm thinking about like
right.
My job, we're 24/7.
Right.
I'm constantly saying to nurses, are you here tomorrow so you can discharge this patient at this time to this place?
Right. So what is discharging involved?
Constantly.
But what is discharging involved?
Printing out the paperwork, making sure all the stuff is in the envelope.
Right, so...
Calling the ambulance in case they don't show up.
Right.
We, like, task all the time for the weekends. We actually have something called the weekend task list.
Right.
Which could vary.
Right. But when you're saying tomorrow...
I'm thinking Friday afternoon.
Right, so you're talking Friday afternoon.
But they're not doing it for you, they're doing it for the patients. Does that make a difference?
Good question.
So right,
you're
so
just giving the orders.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but the patient could be Jewish.
For Achola.
Achola is supposed to leave on Shabbos if they have the opportunity to do so.
Right, right. So right. In other words, what?
So I can hold by that.
No. So in other words, what do you? Right. When you're discharging someone, do they? Right. I guess it's a little different if they're. I think it might be different if they're an employee. I think. And if it's, I need to think about that, if they're an employee as opposed to, if you just sort of say, right, the patient can be discharged tomorrow, does it have to be during daytime hours?
Yeah.
Right.
We get extra money if it's before 12.
Get extra money. So
extra reimbursement.
Right, right. So in other words, what you're saying is, yeah, if an employee might be, let me think about that.
It's interesting.
Back
I mean,
yeah.
I'm just as...
Right. How do you? In other words, what you're saying is that you're telling the person to
either a nurse or a social worker to do X, Y, Z to get the patient out Saturday at 12.
Right.
I set up certain things, but very likely they'll have to rearrange the timing or
right.
Or
so how do we
family or do
that's
something?
Very likely, you've already set up everything.
It's very likely that they would have to change the time because the doctor doesn't write the order until 12:01.
But it's not necessarily.
Right. I mean, what you're sort of saying is that this is the situation, and that I'm not sure if they're working for you necessarily. That's what I'm thinking. Like, I'm not sure if they're really working for you. I don't know if they're working for you.
But I'm triggering the thing happening.
Right. I'm not sure if that's a. No, I'm saying I don't know if that's a Mira. Because they're not doing it. You're just sort of set right. You're setting up. You're triggering it, but you're not necessarily. They're not generally doing it for you. In other words, when this is done, I think that's a distinction. But I'm going to double check that. That's a good question.
Thank you.
I was discharged after Ollie was born on Shabbos Yom Kippur. And they wanted me out the second
it
was over.
Right.
And so they came in at some point to do the paperwork,
right.
And they said, "Don't worry, you don't have to write anything."
Right.
I was like, "Okay,"
right.
You know. So they're filling it in, and as she's filling it in, she's like, "I totally get it. I'm Jewish.
Right.
I know."
And
you're
like, "Don't tell
me that." But again, you're not saying that. That's something that you're not responsible for because there could be a question of tochacha. That should you stop them, but there are leniencies about that for someone who is like completely not observant. There are leniencies not to give tochacha to someone who's completely not observant, but you're not triggering that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I don't think that's an issue at all because you're not telling them to do anything at all. You say I can't do it, and they can decide or not. I think your situation is also different because you're like an employee and you're sort of triggering versus telling. But I want to Krista on that. We all set a note. Just to think about that. The last thing. Okay, I'm sorry. We're ready. I'll try. No, these are great questions. It's great questions. So the.
I like this one also.
Okay. So the kashrus. Okay. So okay. So when it comes to kashrus, so there really are two different issues. There's what's called maris ayin and chashad. There are two different issues if you're doing something. So one issue is that they're going to think that you're not a good person, or they're going to think that what you're doing is permitted. Chishad is based on v'yisim nikiyim, that you have to be someone who is clean. You have to appear to be someone who is observant and following halacha. And if you do something where people are going to think that you're not such an upstanding person, not a kosher, right? You're not an upstanding person. So then that's a violation of Yisim Nikim. That's an issue of Cheshad. If it's Maris Ayin, they're going to think this is permitted. So that I think there. I think it is true by Rav Moshe. So the day of there's Gemara, which we saw on Shabbos, Samach Dal and Amud Beis, where he says that whatever the rabbi said that something is forbidden because of Maris Ayin, it's even forbidden b'chadri chadarv, even in private, because you never know who's watching potentially. Or there could be different reasons why that's so. But for Maris Ayin, it's forbidden b'chadri chadarv, even in private. So even if you're in a, let's say, a restaurant and there are no, you know, from Jews around or people think who know, so there is an issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein takes care of that where he says, but if you're, he says here, if you're starving, there's Tsar and Pseda, the rabbis didn't make that decree. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, his point is that the Cheshad issue, if people don't see you, then there's no problem of Cheshad. If people don't see that you're, if people actually, you do it in a private area, a private restaurant, people outside, they don't know you're Jewish, they don't know you're observant, so there's no concern of Cheshad. The concern of Maris Ayin doesn't apply because it's only a rabbinic prohibition and b'makom tzar logos rabbonah. The rabbis didn't make a decree in cases of tzar. The first Shechter has said that nowadays it's prevalent to have business lunches in non-kosher restaurants. So again, on the other hand, in New York there are a lot of kosher restaurants. But again, if need be, there are there are leniencies in terms of non-kosher restaurants, even though there are, like I said, a lot of kosher restaurants, in New York. You know, it might actually be more of a problem if you think about it. The concern of Maris Ayin is probably more of a problem if there's like a heksher, which is not a great heksher.
That's
how they were. Like, if you go into a place that's like clearly not kosher, then everyone knows you're going to get the fruit salad. But if you go to a place where it's like a questionable heksher, so it actually probably poses more of a Maris Ayin problem than, because people might think that it's.
And that probably happens also because I think a lot of times people just assume that like, kosher style is kosher.
Right.
I think they're doing you a favor by like, taking you someplace like that.
I hate when they do
that. I still remember, I had the secretary was always like, don't try to make food for my birthday. Just don't even try. It's like, it's not worth it.
Don't even try. Because it creates
a bad situation.
Yeah.
I still remember this once. I was a summer associate at Pfizer, the legal department. And I remember, so they took me to, they had one of these like outings or whatever. And I remember they had this, they brought in food from, it's a place not here anymore. It was a fancy place. It's not Lavana. I don't know exactly. I don't know. Some place that's not, it's not around. There's some place not around anymore. And they came wrapped and everything. Of course, what do? They like, they want to heat it up, so they took off the wrapping and they warmed it up. I didn't mind that, but the problem was that there was a waiter who was like, mamish following me around the whole time. I'm saying, just leave it here, it's fine. And he kept like following at some point. I said, like, Kenny, he was totally devastated, but okay, it is what it is. All right, but okay. But in any case, now with fruits and vegetables, so there are two different issues. Is there real non kosher, I don't know, residue, or is there the taste? There's an article written by I didn't show you that, but there's a Rabbi Eli Gersten. It's based on the Shulchan Aruch I showed you in Source 3, and he distinguishes between three scenarios. He says if a private individual cut fruit at home, we assume that it's a problem. If a supermarket or fruit store cut the fruit, we could assume that they have dedicated knives, and even if not, that they were cleaned before cutting. And he writes here, if a restaurant or caterer serves fruit, it is difficult to determine whether a dedicated knife was used and one should rinse the fruit. Sharp fruits and vegetables may not be eaten unless the caterer is cutting these fruits or vegetables in large volumes. So again, someone told me that in these cruises, they're like, they cut a ton of fruit, so that's probably. So if you go to restaurants, so again, to get the fruit, it's probably better if you're getting it cut, it's probably better to ask if they wash it off. Because they're what you're dealing with, since everything's cold, you're probably dealing with like residue or something. If you can, it's not. There's probably rules. It's in a fancy restaurant. If they tell you, like, if you tell them like I'm allergic to anything, meat or something, and they tell you like, if they tell you that they use a dedicated knife and it's an upscale restaurant, there's probably room to be clean. It's probably better to get non-cut fruit, but if it's uncomfortable, there's probably reason to be lenient, especially if it's an upscale place.
Is this leniency just for like work? Because it's
I would as a general matter. Again, it's probably technically okay if let's say you go out with friends or whatever, they know you keep kosher, they want to get you fruit, then you could be completely open about it. So it's probably better to get whole fruits, you know. Again, if you're convinced that they show you that they use a dedicated knife and they're honest and there's probably reason to be lenient there as well. I guess I.
But you mean from a restaurant?
From a restaurant, yeah.
Right, like
yeah.
A fruit store, you can get fruit.
Fruit store, yeah.
But
yeah.
They also probably cut the fruit in large quantities.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably. Yeah, right, right, right.
You know,
right, because you don't know. So I'm saying, so you try to. Like, yes, this body.
Is there any extra issue with pineapple? I don't know why I grew up with, like, pineapple being a problem.
Why, because that's being a sharp fruit?
Yeah,
maybe it's sharp.
Yeah, is that, like, a thing?
So again, if it's sharp, so then... Right. So that does that. So, but then. So, what are you concerned about?
It seems to say even the quantities, right? With the lemons,
right?
They're cutting a million lemons, and
right,
you don't
worry
about lemons.
Right. That's probably not an issue. Yeah. So it's probably not.
So it's the same thing
right.
as anything else, then.
Right. So if they're cutting, so if they're cutting the pineapple, right. If it's large quantities, it's probably not a problem. If it's not large quantities, so then you are probably more concerned because if they're cutting, let's say the pineapple, if that's considered a sharp fruit, then when it cuts the fruit, so then it's somehow if it cut meat before, so then it might transfer taste.
So then just rinsing is not enough. So you're not talking about residue anymore.
Right.
It's different.
Right.
Sharp fruit.
Correct. But if there's a large quantity,
fruit store is good.
Right.
Restaurant bad.
Right, again, but restaurant you ask. Restaurant you ask.
Yeah,
restaurant
good.
You ask.
Okay.
But,
what about
okay.
salads?
There's so many.
So salads.
Right.
So salads. Again, you have to find. I'm more concerned with the salad that they might.
The lettuce.
The question is there more of a likelihood? I just think with like fruit, you probably it's more of a likelihood that you use a dedicated knife.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about vegetable salads when you can make the same assumptions.
So maybe it depends
what kind of lettuce it is. Okay.
Right.
I think fruits are generally better in general. But if you have let's say cut up cucumbers, cut up tomatoes, get a plate of cut up cucumbers, cut up tomatoes, where there's no bug issues. So in a pinch, again, I would do this machatila, but I'm saying like that's what I would do. Also, fruit salad pie looks better than having cut up cucumbers and cut up tomatoes. I'm just saying. Unless you're in Israel, that's Israeli really salad. If you're in a workplace and they have non-kosher, we have a few more. Let me just go a few more, okay? We have a few more. Regarding using non-kosher utensils on a regular basis. So there is a... So again, in practice, if everything's cold, this is we saw the fourth source in Yoredeya. There's only five more minutes. I apologize. We're a little over. Yoredeya, Siman Kuf Chaf Alf Sifei. His point is that if you're all dealing with cold, there's no concern of taste transfer. There's only if it's not sharp. The problem with sharp is if you're cutting and if using a knife and together with something sharp. I didn't get to all the details. But generally, using a spoon or a plate, technically speaking, so there's no. You're only worried about residue, right? In kashrus, you're worried about be'en, residue, and also tam, taste that's absorbed. Mm-hmm. So if you're not, by the way, I'm putting this out there, this is all like, if you're in that situation, it's always better not to rely on that because we all make mistakes. It's better to try to avoid mistakes. I'm just mm-hmm. telling you how far you can go under, difficult situations. Technically speaking, so the Ramah says that if it's cold, so you can use a non-kosher plate that's cold. You can use a non-kosher utensil if it's cold. But again, he says b'derech harai. He says don't do it permanently. Right? We should do it. We shouldn't do it permanently. So that's on an occasional basis.
In my office, we do ice cream parties a lot and
right.
wine.
Right.
So we have the ice cream scooper and the...
We have to do ice cream parties.
Is the ice cream scooper washed?
They do ice cream.
Yeah, and like they know, so it's always Ben and Jerry's. But I don't know what it's been used for in the past. And then the corkscrew for the kosher wine and the not kosher wine.
Well, how's the cork? Does it touch the wine or is it...
I don't know. Just goes into the cork.
Right.
I never do it.
It's a bushel
thing also.
Right.
When I got married, they made a whole thing and I didn't get a chance to look at the wine bottle and they opened it and I didn't drink the wine because it wasn't a wine I recognized.
Right.
That was awkward too.
Yeah. Bring your own. So I think if the ice cream.
No, I'm saying like.
Right.
No, but I'm saying, should I keep a corkscrew in the office?
It's so great to get to drink at work.
What kind of a job is this?
I don't know, right.
So the corkscrew, yeah, I don't. It doesn't sound like it. Yeah, I don't think that's it.
Should not touch it now, right?
My
house
so,
in
right.
Mixed
dances. Right. So the okay, 1 second. So
I don't even say the bar one.
Okay, we'll get there in a second. Okay, that's last thing. So right.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
Okay. So the thing with the that's in terms of that. You probably should not use glass or mugs for coffee because that's hot. So that you shouldn't use that culture. But if everything's cold temporarily, so there might be room to be lenient. Regarding the bar, going to a bar, like at the holiday parties, the Gemara, here's the thing, the Mishnah, I didn't bring you all the sources, but the Mishnah doesn't mention this issue. In the Gemara, like there's all these things that lead to intermarriage, which leads to mixed dancing, right? So this is one of these rules. There are a lot of rules that Chazal made that lead to that they said don't do this because it leads to intermarriage. Right. They're concerned of chasnus. It's interesting. The Mishnah doesn't mention what's called the Sheikhar Shel Akum, the beer, you know, from non-Jews. It did actually. You know, we have Bishel Akum, you know, non-Jews cooking. And we have pasakum, bread baked by non-Jews, but the Mishnah never mentions the Sheikhar Shel Kutim. It only mentions the Gemara, and there are all these qualifications. And the Rama actually comes out and he says, we're talking, by the way, in the place where it's brewed, in the place where it's, you know, it's sold. That's where the concern is. That's the concern that the Shulchan Aruch talks about.
What does that mean? In a brewery?
In a bar.
So where it's sold.
In a restaurant, whatever it is, right? Okay. So I don't think in the workplace, I don't think that would be an issue from that perspective.
So like going out to drinks with colleagues is a problem.
Right. So I'm telling you, the Rabbah says that we're lenient. The Chachmas Adam, Rav Danziger, Chachmas Adam lived in the 19th century, so he says it's a problem. He said, Baal Nefesh, you should distance yourself from this. I know that the YU Rosh Yeshiva say it's much better to go to a non-kosher restaurant and order a Coke than to go than have alcohol. I mean, again, I don't know what I would have done because I'm not an alcohol guy, and I know people think that, you know, it's the culture that you can only move up there if you have alcohol and whatever. So I don't know what to tell you. What I'm saying is that I do know what to tell you, but I don't think it's a good idea. I think if you're going to a holiday party, then. I don't know if you have to drink. Certainly, if it's your spouse, you know, for his work, and he's taking you, I don't think there's any reason for you to drink. I think you should be strict on that. You have the Ramah to be lenient, but it's not.
This is not an issue of going.
No, you can go. You should not an alcoholic beverage.
You're talking about like at a restaurant or anything catered.
It's better. It's catered. No, if they bring it indoor. Like no.
A holiday party was at a place.
Yeah. So I think so. I again, the Chachmas Adam is strict. The Rama is lenient. So, but I know the YU Rosh Yeshiva said we should be strict like the Chachmas Adam for this. So they're different. Right. Again, it's based on this chasnus. So I'm saying I want to be open and honest. There is a difference of opinion. The Rama, like I said, is lenient. He says no. Give the hakel vidus elu. They're all lenient there. The Chachmas Adam is strict.
Does this apply to who you're with or where you are?
No, it's any place.
Even, like if you go to a kosher restaurant for lunch.
No, that's fine. Oh, that's fine. If it's I'm sorry.
But you're with all non-Jews.
Right. No. It's only a problem.
Drinking with non-Jews.
It's only a problem in the Sheikhar Shalkutim, the El Babako Bechiraso, in his, no, in a kosher, in a kosher restaurant, you could drink. And if you bring non-Jews, you could also. We're talking about it in a non-kosher establishment.
What was the difference?
What? Because that's the nature of the decree. The nature of the decree, again, how does it apply?
Alcohol.
No, I understand. So the truth is, this is something, you're correct. I think that some of these rules, right, so the I'm not saying it's a good idea if you go with people to drink and what could happen. Right. I agree with you; it's not a good idea. But in terms of this particular decree and how it was formulated, so I want to be very precise. The way it was is formulated from a halachic standpoint. Okay. So that is talking about shecher shalkuti b'makom b'chiraso. Because what's the concern that you might want to then. The connection you could have with the non-Jew who's selling it to you. No, again, it's not so you could say it's not so relevant now because, you go to a bar, you're not going to be fed away. I understand.
Although that is a cliche.
Right.
Right, right. Okay. So that's, right.
So, it's like a wedding or something.
I mean, a non-Jewish wedding. I mean,
a Jewish
wedding. No, Jewish wedding is fine.
No,
kosher
places, though.
Right. Okay, so I would...
Or a non-Jewish wedding. Where's the line?
Right. So I think it's a non, nobody will know the difference. Right. So in other words, I think it's like a bar or a restaurant.
That's crazy. Bar or restaurant.
Right. Or no, but if they're making all the food in the hall,
right.
So that would be the same considered thing also. Right, you have a soda. It's like, no, you can have a soda.
You know what?
But again,
at work, they all drink wine.
Because it just like to
get a mix. What kind of job do you have?
Nothing.
No, I understand. So I'm saying you have the rabbah. I'm saying you have the rabbah, but I'll tell you this what the Chachma Sodom says.
Right.
So you have to...
Come work at Shalom.
Okay, right. Okay. Anyway, so those are some of the issues involved in the workplace. And thank you. These are great issues that you raised. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, the cruises
very
this past week,
right.
Some of the cruises were so filled with Jews that they ended up having a kosher cafe.
Right, right, yeah.
It was so